Okay, so we are now moving on to the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, known as Samma Vayama or Samma Padana, which roughly means right effort. And so again, we're seeing here the gradual purification. We have done the coarser aspects of purification. We're moving on to the more refined things, dealing directly with the mind. And it's a forward sequence, right? You do the coarser first and the more refined. There's a natural progression here. And at this stage, you're also seeing the what I was talking about before, how the later factors, they kind of loop back and they reinforce the earlier ones. And of course, here it's very obvious that if you purify the mind, then the ability to act virtuously by action and speech obviously is greatly enhanced, right? It comes much more naturally. If the mind is pure, then action and speech also become purified as a consequence. So you can see this two-way conditionality going on there. Okay, so right effort. And this is, again, the standard way it is described in the suttas. It's from the sutta called Analysis in the Magga Sanghita, the Sanghita on the Path. And this is how it is described there. And what, bhikkhus, is right effort? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu generates desire for the non-arising of unarisen, bad, unwholesome qualities. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen, bad, unwholesome qualities. He generates desire for the arising of unarisen wholesome qualities. And he generates desire for the maintenance of arisen wholesome qualities, for their non-decay, increase, expansion, and fulfillment by development. He makes an effort, arouses energy, applies his mind, and strives. This is called right effort. So this is quite the way it is phrased. It's phrased in a very kind of impersonal and kind of philosophical way almost. It's not something that is very very applicable. You don't really feel, I want to do this. It's a bit theoretical from the way it is applied here. It is expressed here. But actually, it is actually very useful, and we will see for the next few sessions how this is very, indeed, very, very powerful and very useful, how to actually apply these formulas. And before I do that, I want to just talk very briefly about how these things are sometimes described in the suttas. So the first one here of these four, these are called the four right efforts. And the first one, you generate desire for the non-arising of bad, right? Negative, unwholesome states. States means mental qualities, right? Mind states, mind qualities. They're not really states. States give this idea of something which is fairly permanent, but obviously they're just things that come and go all the time. So you make an effort, you arouse energy, you apply the mind, and you strive for that. So what does this mean? What is the standard way that this, how this is expressed in the suttas? What is actually going on here? And one of the usual ways that this is expanded or talked about, and this is a very important part of the gradual training, a very important part of the development of the mind, and this is often known as sense restraint. And there is occurs every time the gradual training is expressed in the suttas, the aspect of sense restraint is included there. And sense restraint, that basically is that whenever you have any kind of contact with the world through the six senses, then often we react to the content of those six senses, and we react often either with desire or with aversion or ill will, right? These are the two things that we react to, the input that we get through the six senses. And this happens all the time, right? It's a continuous thing, always continuous input. And a lot of that input is from the mind. So, on a retreat like this, often memories from the past would arise, and those memories will then trigger emotional reaction, and especially they will trigger desires and aversions. You know, you think about somebody, and maybe you like them, so you get some desire, or you don't like them, you get some kind of negativity or ill will arising as a consequence. So the effort here, that is talked about here, is precisely that effort to be aware that this is happening, right? To see, to have such clarity of mind. We can see that this negativity, attraction or repulsion, the ill will or the desire is about to happen. Because this object that you're seeing now, you know it will give rise to such a response from you. So that is what sense restraint is. You are aware of that. You have the mindfulness. And then, because you have the mindfulness, you're able to turn away from that and turn in a different direction instead. There's two things that you need to be able to do sense restraint. You need the mindfulness, the ability to see what's going on, and then you need the ability to turn away. That ability to turn away arises because you understand that this is dangerous. You have built up some perceptions in your mind that help you to look in a different direction. So, for example, if it is somebody you're remembering that you're having some trouble with, right? And they give rise to a sense of negativity, ill will as a consequence. Then you have... There's different techniques you can use, but one of the ways then is also to remind yourself of the good qualities in that person. So as you can see, just before the ill will arises, you turn your mind to the good qualities, you see the good, and then that hinders the negative states from arising. This is kind of a standard technique in the suttas. And it's quite easy. If people have lots of good qualities, it's quite easy to do that. So this is sense restraint, right? And what is interesting about sense restraint, the word restraint sort of implies that we are using force, right? Restraint often means force in the way we use it in ordinary usage. You know, you restrain somebody, you kind of hold them, right? You get the restraining order. It means that they are kind of barred from certain areas. They are kind of forced out of those areas, etc. So restraint has that sense. But actually, it is really much more about wisdom, right? You apply the mind in the right way. You have mindfulness, and you use your mind skillfully to avoid these things from arising here. So that is sense restraint, and that is the first one here. Even though it seems very kind of very theoretical, it's actually a very, very practical thing, and it's the sort of thing that you want to do on a retreat like this. You can really learn how to apply the mind in the right way when you have time and you have, you know, more peace and more mindfulness to actually see what's going on here. And that's the first one. So that's the second one then is he generates desire for the He generates desire for the abandoning of arisen bad and wholesome qualities. So this is if something already has arisen in your mind, you already have some desire for something, or you have some kind of ill will is already arisen, and then it is a striving to abandon that, right? What do we do to abandon that? And this next sutta, I call it two kind of thoughts, is about these two first ways of abandoning and stopping unwholesome things from arising here. And then the two last one, the generate the desire for the arising of wholesome states. This is when we apply ourselves in meditation, right? Or you apply yourself to become more peaceful, or you apply yourself to remember something good, to give rise to joy, samadhi. Whenever you are developing a wholesome quality in the mind, this is what this is about. And sometimes when you get to a state, you have a nice, peaceful state of samadhi, all you want to do is just maintain it. You want to stay there. And then that is the last one here, the maintenance, and then the fulfillment of that state once it has arisen. So you get a nice nimitta, or you're able to watch the breath quite easily. So you want to stabilize that, and you want to keep that going here. This is the last kind of right effort. That is just the basic way that how this works, this idea of right effort. It's all about building up good qualities and reducing bad ones, right? That's all it's about, building up more good qualities and reducing the bad ones. The whole path can be summarized in that. The whole Buddhist path, from the beginning to the end, is a continuous movement of building up the good and reducing the bad. And everything in life can really be can come within that framework if we if we are really serious about spiritual development, everything in life can be seen in those terms, building up the good and reducing the bad qualities. Okay, so now we get to this sutta called Majjhima 19, called Two Kinds of Thoughts. This is one that I usually like to read out on every retreat because I think it is very useful. It gives a very clear guidelines on how to develop the mind, how we deal with the mind. One of the powerful things about this is that it shows us that the most powerful tool of dealing with the mind is using wisdom. Not the willpower, not to force things, not to kind of, you know, say, I don't want to see that, I want to force other things up, but using wisdom so that these things come pretty much by themselves when you use wisdom in the right way. So this is how this sutta goes. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was staying at Savatthi in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, and the Blessed One said this. Bhikkhus, before my awakening, while I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. So this is the first thing the Buddha does. He divides his thinking into two classes, right? But first of all, before my enlightenment or before my awakening, I prefer the translation awakening. It is more literal and it's more meaningful to me than the word enlightenment. Anyway, that's just my personal preference. Many people use awakening these days. While I was still an unawakened bodhisattva. Now, it's important to understand what the word bodhisattva means here. Bodhisattva is the Pali form of the word you may have often heard, bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is one of those Buddhist terms, and it is very common in Mahayana Buddhism. It also occurs in the Theravada or non-Mahayana Buddhism, but it is less common in our tradition, if you like. But what does it mean here? That is the interesting thing, right? The fact that this word even occurs in the suttas is a bit of a surprise, because usually this is considered to be a later idea, the idea of the bodhisattva path, right? How to become a Buddha rather than how to become an arahant. So what is this word doing here, and what does it mean? And what it means, and this is something that you, again, when you read the suttas, it's the only meaning it has in the suttas. This is what the Buddha calls himself after he leaves the home life and goes out in search for awakening, in search for an end to the sufferings and problems of the world, death, you know, all of these things. At that point, he calls himself a bodhisattva or a bodhisattva, right? So only at that point. So it has nothing to do with this kind of, you know, later idea that we have to, you know, a bodhisattva is somebody who practices for many, many lifetimes, for eons beforehand to purify himself. No, in the suttas, it just means that very last point, from when you leave the home life until the time you actually reach awakening. Because then he is a bodhisattva, right? He is somebody who is searching for awakening. There's a couple of other occurrences in the canon, but I won't go into that now. But that is really how it is actually used. And that then gives rise to the question, what does it actually mean? What does bodhisattva mean? What does bodhisattva mean? And often the word bodhisattva, the way it is understood, the word sattva can have different meanings. The way it is often understood is a being, and bodhi is awakening. So it often translated as something like awakening being, right? Awakening being. It's a bit strange, isn't it? Awakening being? What does that mean, awakening being? What do you mean, awakening being? And it is a bit weird, but of course, words are sometimes weird, so that doesn't mean it isn't right, but it's still somewhat strange. But there are some people who suggest that the meaning isn't that at all. The meaning actually is something else. These words, all the Pali words, are related to Sanskrit word, and the relation between the Pali and the Sanskrit can often be quite complicated. They can be translated one way or the other, and there can be a complicated relationship here. So other people have suggests that actually what this word means is equivalent to the Sanskrit word sakta. And sakta in Sanskrit means somebody who is searching for something who is aiming or looking for something. Yeah. So then bodhisattva means someone who is searching for awakening, right? Someone who is aiming for awakening. Yeah. And of course, that is exactly what the Buddha does after he gives up the home life and goes out in search for an answer to the problems of life. So that is a very interesting suggestion that that's what it means. I think that is quite right. It is the person, the unawakened person, who is in search of awakening, right? That is what bodhisattva means. So this is, maybe all of this seems a bit kind of strange to you that I should go into such detail about such minor matters, but these are the sort of things that become interesting the more you delve into the suttas. These things become quite fascinating here because they throw a bit of light on Buddhist history, right? Where do these terminology come from? If you don't understand that the word bodhisattva here is used in a special way, you think it might be similar to the way it is used in the rest of Buddhism. But actually it isn't. So these things are important for historical reasons. They're important to understand the evolution and development of Buddhism. All of these things actually, they can matter quite a bit, especially if you really get into the nitty-gritty of what these things refer to. So if you find it uninteresting, please allow me to indulge a little bit in these things, because I certainly find these things interesting here. So then it occurs to him that right while he's on the path, he's trying to find, he's searching for awakening. He's a bodhisattva, not the bodhisattva, right? He's searching for awakening here. And then it occurs to him, suppose I should divide my thoughts into two categories. And of course, these two categories are exactly equivalent to what we saw before under right intention, right aim, exactly the same categories. So you can see the Buddha here is basically for understanding that he's understanding the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? This idea of right aim, I need to divide my thinking, my mental state, into two things. And one thing is to be pursued, and the other one is to be avoided. That is what he is saying here. And of course, this is this may, on the surface of it, seem quite obvious, but it's not obvious, not really all that obvious, because one of the important points to understand is that these defilements or these kind of thoughts, they have a large variety of categories and types and strengths and relating to the different senses and all these kind of things. This is a vast grouping of different kind of thoughts that come under these headings, right? So this is part of the understanding. To be able to classify your thinking properly into two categories, you actually need quite a bit of insight and understanding of your own mind to be able to see everything in your mind in such a way that you can classify it in these two different ways. Desire can be extremely subtle. Even ill will can be very, very subtle, right? So you need to understand all the subtleties, and only when you understand everything is it possible to deal with these things fully and overcome all the negative intentions, all the negative thoughts, and move on to all the good ones. So this is actually more difficult than it might look at first sight. And it's often like that in the suttas. Things are often much more depth to them. They're kind of said in a very kind of by-the-by way, right? Yeah, you do this, you separate your thoughts, and it all sounds very nice and easy, but actually, very often, these things, in one way they are easy in the superficial way, but in another deeper way in which they are also very profound. So it can be read on many different levels. And then, the Buddha-to-be, the Bodhisatta, right? Not the Bodhisattva, the Bodhisatta, just reinforcing that. It says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. Right? I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. Let me read the whole paragraph first of all. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered, this leads to my own affliction, my own suffering, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of others, of the suffering, it subsided in me. When I considered, this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. when I consider this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. Okay, this is a very, very rich paragraph right there. There's a lot of meaning in this very simple little paragraph. The first thing here is that he says, I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. Diligent here is appamada or appamatta, right? So this idea of being heedful, right? It's not diligent, it's not such a good word perhaps, because diligent to me means somebody is really working hard, right? But it's not so much that you are diligent in your work and working hard, but it's more like you are careful. You are circumspect. You observe, you're watching out. You don't kind of allow things to happen by themselves. You have a sense of wisdom. Yoniso Manasikara perhaps is involved there. And then you are ardent. Ardent here is a word that basically means like energetic. Atapi is the Pali word. It has a sense of, energetic. And resolute is the last one. This is related to the word effort that we saw at the beginning here, the sixth factor, related to the word effort. So you're putting in effort. You are being energetic and you are being heedful. You're being careful in what you do. So as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, he's talking about what he has just been doing, right? Thus, referring back. So this idea of dividing your thinking into two classes, putting aside on the one hand the negative state and on the other side the positive state, that itself is being diligent, ardent, and resolute, right? This is what being energetic means, and using effort and being heedful. That's quite interesting, isn't it? Because you think dividing into two classes isn't necessarily being so energetic, it's just you're just dividing things into two classes. But this is again why these words often refer to. Making an effort often means making an effort in the area of wisdom, right? This is an aspect of wisdom. When you divide the thinking up into those that are negative need to be overcome, those that are positive and need to be developed. So being energetic, making effort, actually often refers to the idea of being wise about things. Not to kind of, grit your teeth and kind of, press the tongue against the roof of your mouth, as it says other places in the sutta. It's not that kind of effort necessarily. It's a very subtle effort. It's the way of using the mind that this is often referring to. So this is an important thing to keep in mind. When the suttas use these words that sound like you're supposed to, really kind of use willpower, it is not as simple as that. I mean, even in wisdom, there's a little bit of willpower involved, but it's very small compared to the kind of willpower we use to concentrate or to force things or to, that sort of thing. And what he does is that he then, a thought of sensual desire arises in me, right? That too is quite significant. Just remember, we're here talking about somebody who is about to become a Buddha, right? Later on, he talks about thoughts of ill will and thoughts of harming. Right? If somebody is about to become a Buddha, this is not just anybody. Or maybe it is just anybody, because that's the point. Obviously, what we're seeing here is that he is having the same kind of mind state that everybody else has, right? And this is one of those things that when you read it, this is like an autobiographical sutta where the Buddha talks about his own life. And what you find when the Buddha talks about his own life is that he is very much like us, right? Very many of the qualities and things that the Buddha talks about, we recognize. These are the same problems we are having. And what you start to see when you do that, you start to see the Buddha as a person. He is a real person. He's a real being. He's not something too kind of highfalutin. And this is, I think, a very important point to remember. It's so easy. It is easy to kind of put the Buddha on the pedestal and make him to something other than human, something more, right? But that is missing the point. If you do that, then all of these autobiographical suttas where he talks about his own life and he tries to inspire us with his own practice, etc., all of that becomes kind of pointless. because there's no relationship between somebody who is different from us and us. What he is doing has no relationship to what we should be doing. But if he is human, if he is one of us, then of course it becomes very powerful, because then his example becomes an example for what we should be doing as well. This is so important. And I think that traditionally the idea of a Buddha is sometimes placed too high, is perhaps the wrong word, but placed on the wrong kind of level, right? Something other than human. And the more you go into the Mahayana tradition, the more distance there is between the Buddha and ordinary human beings. There comes a point when you start to read those Mahayana suttas, I haven't read much of it, but I've read it occasionally, where you feel there is no, you can't really relate to this being or whatever it is. You don't even know what it is anymore. It's something different anyway. So this is important, and this to me is very important, because the Buddha is human. Of course, the Buddha had some very special qualities, right? He had brought the human state to a very high level of development. When he talks about sensual desire, we're probably talking about fairly subtle things, right? Probably very subtle things, but still, we're talking about roughly the same where all human beings are at. So please keep that in mind. Remember these things when you see this, because this is the Buddha talking about himself. And what he understood was, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. Again, it sounds very simple, but remember what I was saying before. This idea here is that you have the full understanding. You understand the full range of sensual desires. You know when even the most subtle things have arisen. And so you have this full and deep understanding. And this is what, of course, if on the path of meditation, this is the kind of thing that you are aiming for, to understand these things, defilements, fully. When you understand them fully, you can also fully abandon them. That is kind of the consequence of that. And only then, when you fully abandon them, can you attain the really deep states of meditation. First thing he does, he knows it has arisen. And then he thinks, this leads to my own affliction. This leads to the affliction or suffering of others. This leads to the affliction of both, right? It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. And when he considered each one of these, then when I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me, right? So when you understand that there is a problem here, that this leads to suffering, it leads in the wrong way, this is for the suffering of oneself, then the thing subsides in you. It disappears, because you don't want to pick up a hot coal that you know is going to burn your hand. This is basically what it is. When you have a full understanding that something is a problem, the mind just drops it all by itself. This is just the nature of the mind. It's the nature of us also with a physical body. If you by accident touch something which is really painful, then your hand just kind of draws back on its own. You don't have to think about it very much. So this is the first thing, right? I understood that sensual desire leads to my own affliction. Right? This is quite profound. For the vast majority of people, it is not always easy to see why sensual desire should be a problem. Usually sensual desire is kind of people celebrate that, right? You have to have fun, you have to enjoy the senses and enjoy all the pleasures in the world, and if you don't do that, you're just being silly. But of course, the Buddha sees these things from a higher perspective. He sees these things from the possibility of attaining deep states of samadhi, of profound stillness. And then when he looks at those sensual pleasures, he sees they're burning. They're burning because they're restless. They're always moving. They're not satisfied. You're agitated. You never actually reach. You never feel fulfilled. You're always moving forward towards something. You're never getting where you actually want to go. As long as there's desire and sensuality is always involved, desire is always involved with sensuality, you never reach the thing. You're always moving forward, right? Always moving towards something. Samadhi, by contrast, you are here, you are there, you are fully satisfied, you're absolutely content, you feel complete for the first time in your life. There's nowhere else that you want to go. And in comparison, one is just suffering, it's burning, it's unpleasant. It's not the pleasure itself which is the problem, it is the craving which is the problem. And these things are almost always caught up with craving. So this is the thing that you understand. I'm burning myself. Why am I allowing myself to be burned in this way? And this is quite profound. And it is only gradually, as you go deeper and deeper in meditation, it is possible to see these things and see how bad it actually is. We will see some similes the Buddha uses later on to talk about sensual desires. And they're very kind of strong similes. And they're virtually impossible to understand. You have to kind of take them on board on the basis of confidence at the beginning, because they are so strong in how they expresses this particular problem. So anyway, don't, you know, think about these things, reflect on them, and if you can see there is something to this, then good. And if you find it hard to see what is going on, I'm sure you can see some of the things here. I think some of the things are pretty obvious. Good. But use this as a reflection, right? Why is all this craving a problem, right? Think about what craving leads to. It leads to attachment. When you're attached to things, you're vulnerable to suffering, because the attachment, the thing you're attached to, will eventually be taken away from you. All of these things are the problems in craving. You're opening yourself up for suffering, and it is suffering in its own right. So this is what the Buddha is... this is how the Buddha to be is thinking. And by thinking like that, he lets go, and things just drop, right? It's like you touch something very painful, like a hot plate. You put your hand on it by accident, and you just withdraw. The hand withdraws automatically. You don't need to think about it, right? In the same way with the mind. When the mind sees suffering, when you see that there's a problem, the mind just withdraws. You don't have to do anything here. There's no willpower involved. It happens by itself. And this is why this is called wisdom power, right? As in Brahma's expression, this doesn't occur in the suttas, but that's what it is, wisdom power, because it's much more powerful than using will. I think this is a very important point. If you use will, you know, if you know that you don't want to be angry, or you know you don't want to have these fantasies, right, that you might have during your meditation, and then you use willpower to kind of pull the mind away, after a while you get tired, right? And then when you get tired, what does the mind do? Go straight back where it's not supposed to go, right? This is the problem. You kind of use up the energy in the mind, and then it doesn't work anyway. The mind goes back again. But with wisdom, so first of all, it's tiring, and secondly, it doesn't really work most of the time to use willpower. But with wisdom, it's the other way around. It's not very tiring. There's a little bit of effort just in, you know, attending in the right way. But then, if you are able to attend in the right way, it disappears completely, because the mind lets go, because the mind understands that this is suffering, this is a problem, I don't want to go there. This is the power of wisdom. That is why it is so powerful. It is able to do what willpower can never actually do. And it's gone. So sometimes this is maybe hard to see fully, because maybe you have never actually experienced this kind of thing before. But you will, you know, over time you will see that this, at least you will see some of the truth of this as you try out these methods. And then, of course, he thinks it leads to the affliction of others, right? Sensuality leads to other people being afflicted. Why is that? Well, because when you have a lot of desires, you end up doing stupid things as a consequence. And, you know, the classic thing, of course, that people do as a consequence of desire is having extramarital affairs, right? You're basically breaking the trust of whatever relationship you're in. This is the classic thing. And most of the time people regret that bitterly afterwards. But when you are enthralled to that desire, you don't see clearly. You're blind. You don't understand what's going on. This is the problem with desire. It blinds you. It makes you do things against your own better judgment, against your own interest, things that you regret later on. And then you lose a lot of things that really you actually want in life, right? Your whatever it is, your family, etc., etc. And so this is one way that it affects others. Another way is that when we, as I just said, when we have desire, attachment is always just behind desire. And once we are attached, we tend to cause conflict, because often we want the same things as other people. We fight over things, and then conflict arises as a consequence of desire. So desire and ill will are very closely related to each other, and they often go together. So this is why it's a problem for others. And then lastly, it is a problem for both to my own affliction and to the affliction of others. Both, right? It's not as if you can be the martyr. You can be the martyr who kind of, I will take the suffering, but then other people will be happy. No. With sensuality, it doesn't work like that. There's no martyrdom. You are, if you, both parties suffer in these kind of things. So. And that is, I think, one of those great little definitions of what is a real kind of Buddhist or spiritual practice. A Buddhist or spiritual practice is any practice where both you and the other person benefits, right? If both people benefit, then it is a spiritual practice. So when you are generous, then of course the other person benefits. You benefit too. When you're kind, obviously the other person benefits, but you benefit too. When you abandon sensuality, you benefit, and so does the other person. When you abandon ill will, both parties benefit. So this is, I think, why that is there. It's always both parties that benefit from these kind of things. And then lastly, when he considered that this obstructs wisdom, this is panya nirodhika. Panya nirodhika means literally makes wisdom cease. It causes difficulties, it causes problems, it causes all kind of negative mind states. It's actually unpleasant to experience desire when you understand what it is. And it leads away from nibbana, right? Nibbana is extinguishment. Nibbana means to be cool. In maybe not in all ways of the word, but in some ways of the word, it means to be cool, right? To cool down, not to have the fires inside anymore. Nibbana means the ending of all of these kind of problems. So for that reason, obviously, if it obstructs wisdom, again, to me, always wisdom has been kind of the highest, one of the highest faculties, one of the most beautiful words. Of course I want to be wise. I mean, you have to be mad not to want to be wise. Because if you're wise, it means you see things clearly. You understand how to overcome problems in a real, profound sense. It means you can help others and you can help yourself. Wisdom, surely, is something very incredibly valuable. And if desire obstructs that wisdom, and as I showed you before, how it obstructs when you desire things, you make the wrong decisions, decisions that you regret later on, then of course you don't want to have anything to do with that. And then it leads away from nibbana to the cool, to the highest, the ending of defilements, to the end of suffering. It leads away from all that. And when you see that, and when you see that clearly, when you see the connection between these things, and this is kind of the tricky part, to see the connection, you have to see how this actually works. And to be able to do that, you have to reflect on this for yourself, to think about these things, to develop these ideas, to understand why it is the case. And then gradually you start to get a feeling for what is going on. And then he says, whenever a sensual thought arose in me, I abandoned it, I removed it, I did away with it. Right? These are very strong words in the Pali. These are words which basically means, elsewhere to translate as, I obliterated it, is one of Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, right? You obliterate something, it sounds very, very kind of harsh, right? Lots of willpower. You do away with it, you remove it, abandon it, obliterate it, etc. And all of this sounds like an incredible amount of willpower. But what we have just seen, and that is what is so interesting about this, we have just seen actually, no, it doesn't really involve that much willpower at all. What it involves is wisdom, right? And this is kind of an important thing to understand, that when you see these words that seem to have a certain meaning in English, and you think that, well, this must truly mean lots of willpower, just mean that I really apply myself, I really use the force of the mind, the force of my personality to deal with these things. That's what you think it might mean, but actually, no, it shows you right here, it doesn't mean that at all. It means something else, it means using wisdom instead. And again, the reason why, of course, is that wisdom is actually far more powerful. If you really want to obliterate these things, if you really want to do away with them, willpower is not going to work. It is only wisdom power that will be able to do that. So actually, it does make sense that it should be wisdom rather than the will. it actually is the only way that it actually is going to work. Wisdom turns your mind around, turns it away, and turns it in a new direction. So when you see these words in the Pali Canon, sometimes be careful with your interpretation, understanding, because the meaning is often much more subtle than what you might think. So there you are. This is how he abandons any remaining defilements in the mind. Okay. So that is sensual desire, and now we have the two other thoughts that he has classified as being no good, and that is the thoughts of ill will and the thought of cruelty, or as I was saying yesterday, the thought of being ruthless, ruthlessness, or perhaps harming. And it's exactly the same principles are used again. As I abided thus, diligent or heedful, energetic and resolute, a thought of ill will arose in me. And then the whole thing is repeated for ill will, and then for cruelty or for ruthlessness. A thought of ruthlessness arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of ruthlessness has arisen in me. This leads to my own suffering or affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from Nibbana. When I considered thus each one of these, then it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of ruthlessness arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So, I say exactly the same way of thinking. You're using your wisdom to abandon these things, right? In this case, it is much easier to see. With sensual desire, it can be quite hard to understand why it should be a problem. It is, there is a lot of enjoyment in these things for the vast majority of people. It's quite difficult, and it is almost like you don't really want to see that it might be a problem, because if you see it, it's almost like as if you feel you're giving up your happiness in the world. But once you understand that it actually leads to a higher happiness, then of course, that's when it becomes easier to give it up. But with ill will and ruthlessness or harming, it is much more easy to see why these are problems. We all know what it is like to be angry. We all know how that distorts one's outlook, how it leads to all kinds of interpersonal problems. Nobody really likes angry people, right? It's just unpleasant to be around somebody who's angry. If they are angry occasionally, that's fine. We forgive that. But if they're angry a lot, then often people don't want to be friends with them. They don't want to be around them. It's just too unpleasant. So it leads to lots and lots of problems. I think a lot of the problems in the world that we see around often arise. The anger or ill will is an element in all of these things. If we didn't have any anger, how could we have any wars, right? How could we have any all of these problems that we have around the world? Sure, it is also, desire is also an aspect to these things, no doubt, but all of these things are caused to a large extent by all these kind of defilements, really. So it is a massive problem, and I think that probably, I'm sure all of you here understand that this is a problem. But remember also that the problem with anger is that it is also seductive, right? It seduces you. You think, I got to be angry here. It's righteous indignation. This is wrong. This is bad. And if I'm not angry, I'm not doing my job. And this is how people often feel. I know especially people who like to be kind of on the activist side of things, right? What they often say is that anger gives me the energy to be an activist. If I'm angry, then I go into the world and I do good as a consequence of the anger. This is one of those arguments. It gives me the energy. But if you know your mind properly, you actually know that the energy actually gets not, you don't actually get energy, especially in the long run. You don't get energy from angry. Anger saps your energy. It might give you a boost straight away while you're angry, but then you have to pay back later on. And payback is always feeling tired, feeling depleted, feeling you have no energy at all. So anger is this deluded kind of energy that you have for a while, and delusion comes with it. You don't really fully understand what is beneficial for other people or yourself anyway. Now, if you're going to be an activist, isn't it useful to know what is beneficial for people? If you get blinded on the way, then you might do a little bit of good, but you might do damage at the same time. So it's much better to have the energy that comes from a pure mind. That is a very powerful energy. And it's an energy which has clarity with it at the same time. You're not deluded. You actually do understand what is in people's best interest. So those people who want to be angry so that it gives them energy, they should really look a bit more carefully and understand that actually in the long run, the long-term consequences is depletion of energy. It's a bit like going on a drug, right? You're on a drug, and it might give you a high right now, but in the long run, the consequences can be terrible. If you get addicted and you use this all the time, eventually you have to use the drug just to feel normal. And that's when you really have lost out a big time. And it's a similar kind of thing with anger. It's like a drug. It's intoxicating, right? It makes you do things. So be careful, although we can understand the danger of these things, it is sometimes easy to allow oneself and to go under the spell of these things. So again, you reflect in the same way, and as you reflect in the same way, you abandon all of these things through the power of wisdom. Right? So you sit here in your meditation, you have a thought starting to arise about somebody, you know that this is leading in the wrong direction, and so you shift to the good qualities of that person, or you shift your perception to somebody else altogether. Either way, you shift your attention one way or another. This is how you deal with this in the meditation itself. And then after a while, you learn also how to deal with these things in daily life, even when you're not on a meditation retreat. Okay, so then we go on to the next paragraph. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders thoughts of sensual, of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of non-harming to cultivate the thought of harming, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of harming. So this is this idea, right, that if you cultivate this in the right way, if you are able to lean your mind in the direction of metta, loving-kindness, direction of compassion, the direction of renouncing craving, the more the mind leans in that direction, the more you are able to kind of guide the mind there, the more natural becomes that state for the mind. So it's fascinating to see this in practice. You can see this over time. You can see how your anger and all these negative things, how they reduce over time. They become less and less. And after a while, it's just natural, right? That's where your mind inclines. It becomes like an automatic thing. You don't have to force yourself so much anymore. These thoughts don't come up as much anymore as they used to. And that, of course, is an incredible benefit. You meditate and you just feel at ease. You feel relaxed. You don't have to always guard yourself from all these things coming up. It is much more habitual. You go out into the world, you meet other people. It's much more habitual to not react in the negative ways. So this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to create new habits, basically. A new personality, a new outlook, the way we think about things becomes much more habituated in a good sense. And what a wonderful thing that is when that happens, right? You feel better, everything is kind of heading in the right way. So your mind is inclining in the right direction. And then we have a nice simile here. Just as in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn, when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation and defilement, and in wholesome qualities the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So here is the cowherd, right? So you are like a cowherd. You're guarding your mind. Your mind is like the cow, right? So your cow is all, your cow in your mind is always straying in the wrong direction. So you're tapping and poking it a little bit by kind of, you know, saying, don't go there. Look at this instead. Don't look at that. Look at this way. Tap, tap. Go here. And then they kind of the, after a while, your cow becomes, does the right thing, right? So this is the idea here. Your mind is a bit like a cow. So I once said somewhere, you know, cows aren't so smart. They aren't, you know, they're not such intelligent. And perhaps this is the same thing with our mind. It's not really all that smart. But then somebody said, oh, no, cows are actually quite smart. They're actually quite intelligent creatures. Sometimes you have to be careful what you say, because you can always put your foot in it, no matter what you say, pretty much. Anyway, so he sees that he could be flogged, right? Imprisoned or fined or blamed. And this is the idea that you will suffer as a consequence if you don't tap the cow out of the field. You will suffer. If you don't guard your mind in the right way, you too will suffer as a consequence. You will be kind of fined or blamed or imprisoned or flogged in a different way. And so too, I saw in unwholesome states, but the danger, in other words, the potential for suffering. Degradation literally means here that you're making okara, it means you're making the mind low. The mind feels lower. A lofty mind is a mind which is free from defilements. A low mind is a mind which is is defiled, because it's almost like it almost feels that way inside of you. When the mind feels pure, it feels lofty, it feels elevated. There's something high-minded in a sense about that, and something low-minded about too many defilements. And he saw the danger of defilement. In a wholesome state, the blessing of renunciation, of giving these things up, the aspect of cleansing, right? The path of purification, the path of cleansing the mind, getting rid of the defilements. Okay, so that is the first half of that sutta. And the second half is exactly the same, but in the reverse. So I think we can probably have a quick look at that as well before we stop for this afternoon. This is the second half of this sutta. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. Thought of renunciation means that, maybe good to explain what that means. It means a thought that you don't want to have that craving, right? It's a feeling of, no, I don't want to crave. It's an aversion towards the craving, a kind of sense that you want to let go of the craving of all these sense pleasures. Because you see the danger, you can understand the suffering in that. That's what a thought renunciation is. Or a feeling, sometimes it may not be all much of a thought, but a feeling or a perception of renunciation. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, right? Does not cause difficulties, and it leads to nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire the body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. So this is the opposite case then. When you're actually thinking the good thoughts, you're thinking about renouncing. And further down, you're thinking about non-ill will, right? Metta, non-harming compassion. You're thinking all these good thoughts, and you know that these are actually aiding you. They're helping you move in the right direction towards nibbana, towards more wisdom, and all of these things. But the interesting point that is being made here is that despite the fact that this actually is helpful, this is good stuff, despite that, thinking is always tiring at the end of the day. It drains your energy. You can only sustain thinking for so long. And then as it says here, if you think too much, it tires the body. Quite literally, you feel physically tired, right? You know, it's like if you think, eventually you feel tired, you want to go to sleep. And then that affects the mind. It's interesting here how the mind and body are separated in this way. And then the mind becomes strained, right? Tired as well. And then you are far from samadhi. So what this whole paragraph, what this whole thing is telling us is that there is a graduation here in thinking and how we use the mind. First of all, we overcome the negative states of mind. And we overcome those negative states of mind with the beautiful and the positive states of mind. Then once we have established the positive states of mind, then we go into samadhi, then we go into deep states of meditation, right? So it's important to remember that. This is a kind of a sequence that we have to use. In fact, you can even divide it up into more steps if you want to. First, we overcome the coarser aspects of the mind, the really bad ones, then the more refined ones, then the really refined ones. Then we overcome the good ones, and then eventually we go into a state of samadhi. It's a gradual thing, right? A gradual development, a gradual purification that is happening here. So this is another thing that this sutta is telling us, how we have to go through this process in the right way. And then meditation starts to work, and we're able to enter these states of samadhi as a consequence. So the Buddha-to-be, he says here, I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. This is a standard wording, basically is a reference to the jhana states, the deep states of samadhi. And then, of course, he avoids the straining of the mind. And then the same thing happens with thoughts of non-cruelty or non-ill-will. So here we're talking about metta and compassion especially. As I abided thus, diligent or heedful, energetic and resolute, a thought of non-ill-will arose in me, a thought of non-harming or ruthfulness arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of ruthfulness has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to the affliction of others or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire the body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from samadhi. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and stilled it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. A strained mind is bad, because a strained mind is not balanced, is not even, is not able to be applied for insight, right? So here the whole purpose here is to move towards the highest insights on the path. So you want to have a mind which is very at ease, relaxed, just able to sit back and watch kind of this upeka, one of the highest kind of qualities on the Buddhist path. So then we have continue here. Bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, upon thoughts of non-harming or ruthfulness, as I like to say now, he has abandoned the thought of ruthlessness, to cultivate the thought of ruthfulness. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of not being ruthless. So again, this idea that once you establish these thoughts, right, they become your habit. They become who you are. They become part of your personality. And this is kind of the idea. And this is why you can see once they are part of you, when you sit down to meditate, right, and all you do is wait, you just sit back, you allow things to die down, you allow all the tiredness of your ordinary life to kind of fall away by sleeping enough, the restlessness to pass away. What happens is that your natural personality starts to shine through. So if your natural personality, your natural habits are these kind of thoughts, then that is what arises, right? And that's why meditation becomes possible. And that's why all of this sila, all of this virtue, all of these practices are so powerful in aiding your meditation practice. Because you become, quite literally, this kind of person. And then this, then, is what comes through in your meditation practice. So all you have to do is wait. You sit back, and as you wait, your natural good qualities come out. And then everything is so much easier. I'm just trying to tie things together a little bit so that you can see how this ties together, because it is all part and parcel of the same thing here. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops had been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was for me only need to be mindful that those qualities were there. So now, the cowherd, he doesn't have to worry too much. There's no chance of being fined anymore, right? He can just sit back, lean against the tree, kind of lazily watch the cows with one eye and kind of half doze off with the other one, right? And it's not quite like that, that you should be doing your meditation practice. But the idea is that all you have to do now is be mindful, right? You are aware the good qualities are there. You don't have to kind of boss your mind around so much anymore. You don't have to apply your wisdom so actively as you did before. So you're just mindful that the good qualities are there. And then the very last one here, this is the sutta actually goes on after this. I forgot to put that this too is just an extract, actually. It goes on after this, but this is the last one that I included for now, because the rest becomes too profound, and we'll have a look at that towards the very end of the retreat. And then he says, tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind stilled and unified, right? Well, this is what happens when all the defilements are abandoned, when all you have are good states of mind. You feel natural energy inside. The mind is bright, energy is strong. All those good qualities are there. This is a consequence of abandoning the defilements. This is part of what I meant when I talked about brightness before. Part of the brightness of the mind is the energy of the mind. So the mind, the energy is strong, the mindfulness is unremitting, like, right, it's always there, right? It never ceases. You're always mindful, always aware. There's no defilements to drag you into the past, no defilements to push you into the future. You stay in the present moment. It's always the defilements that take the mind out of the present moment. And this is why mindfulness gets established once the defilements start to die down. The body is tranquil and untroubled. Again, the body too is affected by these defilements, and the mind finally is still, right, unified, and all you have is happiness, all you have is bliss, no problems in the mind anymore. And from there, you can go even further, and eventually, and after this, the Buddha talks about the very last stages, how eventually he then reaches full awakening on this basis. Okay, so that is the two kinds of thought for you. I've gone just marginally over time, but thank you very much, and I'll see you again this evening.